The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Space Show Special Edition, Tuesday morning, West Coast, United States time. I'm your host, David Livingston, and thank you for being here. This is a very special show we're having today with Dr. Heinrich Pace, and he is in Germany, and I'll tell you more about that in just a minute. Our program will be a variable-length program today, so if you do want to talk with our guest on our toll-free number, please give us a call. We love your phone calls. It is 1-866-687-7223. And you can also email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com or use our blog for getting a hold of us, and that is thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is our program today in the upcoming show menu, our first program today, starting with Dr. Heinrich Pace. And if you post a comment, just scroll down on the bottom of that show, and you'll see an area for comments and questions. And as soon as you hit the send button, I'll get it and can bring your question or comment into our real-time discussion. Don't forget that we have a newsletter. It goes out at 6 a.m. West Coast time Monday morning. If you would like to receive that free, very short newsletter, make sure I have your email address, and I'll be happy to add you to the list. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or download the program or listen on all sorts of different podcast servers. We do have a Space Show store if you're interested in logo wear, so you get to that store by clicking on Pepper, the Siberian Husky, who listens to the Space Show, and she will take you into our logo wear store. Probably the most important, as I stress this, is that the Space Show is a 501c3 United States nonprofit, and that means that if you donate to the Space Show and you pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax donation for your gift. We are listener-supported radio, so we depend on your financial support to bring you these programs, these great guests like the one you're going to hear from in just a few minutes. There is a big PayPal button on the upper right side of our homepage. That's the easiest way to support the Space Show. But for those of you who use Zelle, Z-E-L-L-E, the email address connected to Zelle is david@onegiantleapfoundation.org. That's our nonprofit. And then, of course, you can make out a check and go old school to One Giant Leap Foundation, and it mails to our headquarters in Las Vegas. That address is on our website and our PayPal button. If you, for some reason, can't find it or have questions, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And I want to remind you also that we have sponsors and advertisers. Those sponsors get banner ads running across the homepage for their products or services. They can change it whenever they want. On the longer format shows, I read a brief sponsor message. And on all programs, I shout out to our great sponsors, because the truth is we would not be doing this show without them. So I want to seriously thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, the National Space Society, and Dr. Chaim Ben-Roya for his two books on lunar development and lunar structures and space habs. If you're interested in being a sponsor, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our guest today, Dr. Heinrich Pace, has a new book out. That's what we're talking about today. It is titled The One, O-N-E, How an Ancient Idea Holds the Future of Physics. He is a professor of theoretical physics at Dortmund University in Germany. He has also been at Vanderbilt and the University of Alabama, plus the University of Hawaii, and he has done research at CERN, as well as Fermilab, and he is in the Bremen, Germany area. Professor, welcome to the Space Show. It is very nice to have you as a guest, and thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Can you start out, and let's introduce your book and what it's about and what the concept of the One is all about, and then we can take it and go deeper after you introduce us to all of this.
Yeah, my book is, there are different ways to talk about the book. It's about quantum mechanics, what quantum mechanics truly means and what it means for present cutting-edge research in physics. But on a different level, it's essentially about everything in the universe. And it comes back to a very old idea that essentially everything in the universe is integrated into one single unifying whole, that all is one on some deep level, deep fundamental level. And the reason I'm claiming that this is the case is that if we look at quantum mechanics and we take quantum mechanics serious as a theory about nature, and not just about a theory about our knowledge of nature, as it often has been done, then we realize that there's some hidden quantum reality behind what we experience. And if we consider the quantum phenomenon of entanglement, which was the topic of the 2022 Nobel Prize of Physics, then this phenomenon of entanglement make sure that things in the universe are integrated into a whole, into one unified thing. So this hidden reality, quantum mechanics, entails is a unified whole. And then, of course, there comes the question, why do we experience the world as many things instead of one thing? And this is a matter of perspective. It's related to another quantum phenomenon known as decoherence, and decoherence explains how we experience the world as many things, even if there's only one thing on the fundamental level, due to our perspective onto the universe. And then the book contains a lot of philosophy and history, since I'm also addressing the question why these ideas are not more popular. My take on this is that these monistic philosophies are unpopular in the West since they have been suppressed as heresies by the Church for centuries. And then finally I come to the point why this is important. So many physicists would say, well, maybe this is the case, maybe it isn't, but it doesn't really matter. It's just metaphysical pondering, and it's not important for physics. But my point is, it is important since we have problems in physics right now, in foundational physics. There's a crisis where we have very unlikely coincidences we can't address. And so I think it's time to rethink the basis of our theorizing about physics and take a step back and reconsider how we interpret quantum mechanics And my hope is that this will help us to make further progress in fundamental physics.
Professor, I did not study physics in university, and my background is business and economics and finance. So I'm clearly not a physicist, but when you're saying it's about our perspective, but our perspective isn't seeing what's really happening. So are we being misled by our perspective? Are we somehow automatically duped into believing what we see, but believing what we see is not real? And how does the universe get away with that? I guess it's like we're in a big magic show. Am I somehow missing your point?
No, I mean, the point is we don't see the entire universe at once, right? I mean, if you look at a can of Coke, depending on the angle you look at it, you can see it as a square, or you can see it as a circle, but you never see the entire can from all different angles at once. And in a similar way, we look at the universe and we don't see the entire universe. And if we plug that into the formalism of quantum mechanics, that we have a special perspective onto the universe, then what comes out is that even if the universe is only one thing on the fundamental level, we experience it as many things. And it might even be that we get things we take as fundamental, such as space and time and matter, out of this phenomenon, so that space, time, and matter are not really fundamental. They are also just a matter of our perspective. They are just a consequence of our perspective. So, in some sense, these things are illusional. Space, time, matter don't really exist on the most fundamental level. We experience them. It's a real experience, just as we really see the can of Coke as a circle if you look at it from a certain angle.
But the way we see things, these illusions, as you're talking about, our lives work with them. So if they were really false and not real, how could our lives work? How could traditional physics work? So it seems to me you've got, on the one hand, what the universe is really like, which we can't see all at once, and on the other hand, we're living our lives with a lot of perspectives that are based on illusion, but they make our lives work. We build things with them. We do equations with them. We, you know, make rockets with the laws of physics. And I can tell you I've had numerous physicists on the show over the 22 years of doing the space show, and very few are real quantum physicists. And when I ask them, or a listener asks them, a quantum question, they dismiss it. They can't answer it. They stay away from it. So is what they're doing in physics an illusion, and quantum physics, the quantum, is the real thing? Is that the crisis, that you've got people pursuing illusions and others, a handful, are trying to pursue and perceive the real thing through the quantum world?
Well, I wouldn't be that extreme. I mean,
okay.
As I said, I mean, it's a real experience how we see things. We experience in our daily lives that there's matter, there are many things, things exist in space and time and so on. But on the other hand, in physics, we always want to abstract from the subjective observer. We want to be objective. And already when you look at Einstein's theory of special relativity, usually we experience space and time as two different things. But in relativity, space and time are integrated into space-time. That's also a more abstract object, which is not directly intuitive to our daily life experience, but it's a useful, meaningful physics object. And we can deduce what we experience from this abstract object, even if we don't have a direct experience of it. And I think it's similar with quantum mechanics. There is this quantum reality, which is not directly observable, but it's a useful abstract object, and we should take it serious as a model about nature and derive what we experience from our perspective from this fundamental object.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
We don't experience that the Earth is moving or something like that.
Right? Correct.
But still, we know the Earth is moving around the Sun, right? So,
right.
So it's similar like these things, similar to these things.
So you have a listener question, and this is John in Fremont, California. Can you please explain what entanglement is and how does it connect everything in the universe?
Yeah, thank you, John. Thanks for your question. Entanglement is a fundamental quantum phenomenon. And so in quantum mechanics, a typical thing is that quantum objects can be described both as particles or as waves. And, for example, if you have a wave, you can't assign a specific location to the wave. The wave is stretched out. If you look at the wave, which is on the surface of a pond, for example, it's not at one point at this, on the surface of this pond, but it's stretched out over the pond. So it is in different locations at the same time. And so this is a general property of quantum objects, that they can have different properties at the same time. And entanglement generalizes this property to quantum objects which consist of two or more constituents. And then you can know the complete object perfectly well, but you have no information about the subsystems, about the constituents. Yeah. For example, if you have two particles and they spin in opposite directions, you know that the total system made of both objects is not spinning at all, since the spins of the two components, they cancel. So you know the total object perfectly well, but you know nothing about the individual object, since it could be either the first component which spins left or the second component which spins left, but you don't know which one spins left. The other one spins right, and they cancel each other. You know the complete system, but not the individual system.
You have a caller waiting on hold to talk to you, sir, so hang on. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to get a handle here. I've been listening for 20 minutes. What you mentioned early on, somebody mentioned decoherence. I'm trying to figure out what in general slant or interpretation on quantum mechanics do you tend to advocate? I mean, are you moving away from the classic Copenhagen interpretation toward, is it many worlds type or just some other, just pure decoherence to explain the things like the Schrodinger cat experiment, that kind of thing?
Yes. You are referring to the Copenhagen interpretation. I'm not a big fan of the Copenhagen interpretation. And the reason is that the Copenhagen interpretation doesn't take quantum mechanics really serious as a theory about nature. And the reason is that people found out early on that you can have, for example, these two different descriptions like a particle or a wave for the same quantum object. But you never can experience both these objects at the same time. And then one could think that both these aspects are only perspectives of a deeper reality. But this deeper reality, since you can't observe both aspects at the same time, isn't observable. So many physicists are very hesitant to accept something which is not observable, since physics, of course, is an experimental science. And thus, the early quantum pioneers, such as Heisenberg and Bohr, they came to the conclusion that what we observe is reality, and there's no deeper reality behind that. Even if the quantum mechanical equations describe something like a deeper reality behind that. But they said, well, this is not really reality. It's just a tool to make predictions about what we observe. So this Copenhagen interpretation isn't really a theory about nature. Or according to the Copenhagen interpretation, quantum mechanics is not a theory about nature, but it's a theory about our knowledge of nature. And in my opinion, this is not satisfying. So I want to understand quantum mechanics as a theory about nature. And then you end up with something you said, something like the many-worlds interpretation. But my point is that the many-worlds interpretation, which was proposed by Hugh Everett in the late 1950s, that essentially when you make a quantum, so it says when you make a quantum measurement, all possible results of the quantum measurement are realized, but they are realized in parallel reality. So they coexist in parallel realities. So no possible outcome of a measurement is discarded. Everything happens at once. So this is what you end up with when you take quantum mechanics serious. But my point is that this is only a rather superficial view on the real quantum reality. It's, again, a perspectival impression. And on the foundational level, there's just one quantum mechanical wave function, and all these realities are merged together into a single entangled quantum object. And actually, this is also what Everett himself had in mind. So his first, proposed this interpretation in his PhD thesis, and the first title he had for his thesis was the universal wave function. And then later on, his PhD advisor, John Wheeler, he changed it, and then it was not accepted, and then at some point, Bryce DeWitt republished the paper or the thesis, and he put the label, the many-worlds interpretation, on it. But the many-worlds interpretation is something like, it's kind of a misnomer, since on the fundamental quantum level, there's just one word, a quantum word. And only from our perspective, this quantum word looks like many quasi-classical words.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, there's a lot of things that kind of fit into that. For instance, you look at the idea of the way Feynman looked at interactions as being, you know, all the possible paths sort of being superimposed, you know, to explain what really happens, too. That's another kind of a weird thing where you sort of have many things, but they're all really part of one thing, I guess, right? I mean,
yeah. This is a very typical, very weird quantum phenomenon, that the superposition. And as I said, if you apply superpositions to these component systems, then this leads to quantum entanglement, and then this merges different parts into a whole, and this is my main point, that this is actually the fundamental reality we should start with when we are doing physics.
Yeah, but then we get back to something like the, and that's why I've seen this different way. I know I'm familiar with Sean Carroll's presentations on his ideas along this idea, which sound very similar to yours, I think. And at any rate, like you look at the Schrodinger cat experiment where you have the cat in the box and some quantum phenomenon will have a 50% chance of either killing the cat or the cat living, and an idea of what there is, there's a paradox, you open the box, and it's unlikely that looking at the cat would have any effect on the cat, but just opening a box. So the theory would be, well, that's absurd, but then you mentioned decoherence. Well, the cat's actually already interacting with the environment inside the box before you open it, and that's where the real effect would be. Are you playing into that idea any?
I totally agree with this description. I mean, it's decoherence means that our quantum objects are entangled with the environment. The point which I would like to make is that decoherence is perspectival. It's something which happens only from our perspective, since from a hypothetical outside perspective, where one would look at the entire universe, there would be no decoherence. There would be still one single quantum object where everything is merged together, the live cat, the dead cat, the observer who sees the live cat, the observer who sees the dead cat, and the environment. But only from the perspective of a local observer, and Max Tegmark, for example, likes to call this a frog perspective, we average over the environment, and this averaging over the environment to describe our local perspective on the cat in the box, this leads to decoherence, and this leads to this splitting of the different realities so that we see either a live cat or a dead cat, but nothing in between. But I agree with this description, and I agree with Carol. So I think it's mainly my focus is more on the fundamental reality of a single quantum world than on the many branches we experience from our classical perspective.
Mm-hmm. The only thing with that I find interesting is, from the point of view of the cat, the cat probably has a preference of which happens, but it doesn't seem to really have in the real world. He seems to either gets gassed or nothing happens at all, and somebody opens the box to let him out. So that's what I've always had trouble struggling with. I agree with it on a math, you know, just the theoretical level, but when you try to look at it in your real experience, it's kind of hard to see how that works, you know?
Yeah, it is, yeah. It is. I agree. But to really understand experience is very, very difficult anyway. I mean, we don't really understand consciousness. I think you can't really blame that on the average interpretation that we don't understand consciousness. I mean, I agree it's kind of weird that we have the experience that we have a continuous stream of consciousness, even though according to the average interpretation we would be splitting all the time, and also the cat in the box has the experience that it has, as far as we know, a continuous stream of consciousness, and that it's not splitting, but according to the average interpretation it's splitting. But but this is very speculative, but my take on that is that consciousness and the quantum to classical transition, they have to be explained together. And so then one should find a description which makes this consistent.
Yeah. It makes sense to me. David, is this helping the typical viewer out some, or I hope? Or
well, I don't have viewers. I have listeners. So
listeners, I'm
so
sorry.
Your perspective is wrong in the first place. So,
yeah, I apologize.
I don't know. You know, it may be over the head of a lot of people, and in many ways it's over the head of me. But Professor, I read the book, which I really found very, very interesting, and I found that I couldn't understand the vast majority of it. Again, I don't have the physics training or background that our caller has. And I sort of have always, you know, believed in this interconnected and perspective, and I don't know where it came from, if it was just natural in me or maybe some other books I've read that talk about it in a general way, and it sounds sensible to me. But for the average person living their life, and maybe they know some physics, maybe they don't know some physics, how does understanding this and understanding about perspective and reality, how can it play out, or can it play out to enhance our lives, or is it simply an academic issue for professors in universities and other people like John who have studied physics all their life and in college to get a hold of? Is this applicable to how we live and manage our lives and see things?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question, but I think I can give a few answers to that. Actually, I think it can be important in several ways. First, I think it is important how we conceive of our universe, how we understand the world, and it is important that there exists a rational foundation on which we can build our world model. So, otherwise, we don't have a solid foundation to build our decisions, our assumptions about science, about life decisions, and so on. So I think it is important that we have at least some basic understanding how the world works, even if we don't know all the details. So and according to that, yeah, I think it's important the foundation of science is important, even if you don't understand the details, even for a person who is not a physicist. Then, if I'm right, and this foundation really is this unified whole, may have some positive consequences. For example, it might help us to realize, well, we are not alone, we are not totally separate individuals, but we all stick together somehow within this universe. It might help us to be more cooperative, to be less egoistic, maybe to develop some responsibility for our environment or something like that. So again, this is very vague. It's not detailed, and I think science can't give us really an ethical compass, can't give us rules what moral life is, but at least a philosophy that assumes that we are part of something bigger supports, in some sense, ideas about cooperation over just plain egoistic behavior.
And go ahead.
Yes?
No, go ahead, and I'll
No, I think I'm done, I think.
So while I absolutely agree with what you're talking about, to be the devil's advocate, more and more, and I'm really not interested in going down a political road, but we're seeing people with educations from decent higher levels of education or schools or just really good common sense education, making statements, making policy, doing things that have no root in the foundations of science, and in fact, they're not even scientific. So the other extreme seems to be compelling and guiding people and science at many levels, even in some schools, gets rejected and thrown out because it isn't of the right, who the hell knows what, you know, the right current ideology or something.
Just a second, here's something.
John, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, I'll stay on if I'm helpful, or I'll get off for other people, whatever you want to do. But I,
well, get
I'm
off.
Following it.
Get off, and let's see if somebody else wants to call. Otherwise, you
so
can
sorry,
call back.
Sorry, I'm back. So there was something.
No problem.
Yes, I agree. I mean, this is a problem, and I think we need some solid foundation of science, and we also have to realize that we are not alone. And the last thing I for a moment had forgotten is that it also may comfort us in some sense that we are part of something bigger, that we are not alone in the universe, and
if people listeners, you can call us. Our toll-free number is free and is available. John is off the line for the moment. 866-687-7223. And you do have another call already. But if people want to study science in school, and somebody may be listening who's in high school here in America or getting ready to go to college, what is the path to quantum physics, and is that the path that people should take? Does it replace astrophysics? Does it replace experimental physics or theoretical physics or something like that? I'm trying to see if I guess what I want to know is, is it, in your opinion, a preferred path to being a physicist?
Well, I think quantum mechanics plays a role in many aspects of physics, in almost all aspects of modern physics, with some exceptions. And I mean, all these fields you were mentioning are important, and maybe more important than such fundamental theorizing I'm talking about. I think all of them build on some foundation, and what I'm talking about is foundation. So if you want to work on that, the usual paths would be studying physics and then specialize in fundamental things like particle physics, like quantum information science, like cosmology, and find an interesting research project and go on to graduate school and then start doing your own research on that.
Let's see who your caller is. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please? Hello.
Hi, this is John in Fremont, California.
Another John. Okay, John, go for it. What's on your mind with the good doctor today?
Yeah, hi, Heinrich. I have your book, and I haven't started reading it, but I've read a few things on the web, and I've actually posed some of these questions on David's blog. So I'll ask the questions now, and we'll see where it goes. So from what I understand, you believe that we should take mechanics seriously as opposed to string theory and build physics on a foundation that is the entire universe. And so I think this will require a quantum theory of gravity, which string theory was intended to address but is lacking in experimental evidence. How will monism help unify general relativity with the standard model of particle physics, and what experiments can be designed to test this new model?
Yeah, good question. So the point is, monism is more a philosophical framework. It's not really a physics theory. But monism gives us some directions in which way we should develop our theories. And if we start with the entire universe, and if this entire universe as a quantum object is the most fundamental description, it doesn't make sense to look exclusively at tiny components of the universe. That is the typical approach in particle physics and also in string theory. So the paradigm of particle physics and string theory is to assume that we can build up everything out of very small components, and the smaller the components corresponding to the higher the energy we use to probe these components, the more closer we get to the fundamental level. And I think this is, or this was very, very successful, this approach, for quite some time, but it won't work forever, since at some point we will realize that if we look only at components, we lose some essential information about the whole. And at some point, we should start with the whole and derive everything from there. And I'm not an adversary of string theory. String theory is a very interesting approach and has also brought very interesting insights. But as you say, there's a problem that it's not quite testable, since it develops a theory which is applicable only at very high energies. And my second point is that, in my opinion, it can't be the last answer, since I think if you look at components, at constituents, at very high energies, you ignore the totality of the whole, which quantum mechanics suggests. So, I think at some point we should develop a theory which starts with the entire universe as a quantum object and derive everything from there. But it's not that I have the theory or that I know a good way to develop the theory. I mean, otherwise I would be working day and night and writing physics papers and not writing books. It's more like that I think this should be the way to go. And there are, in my opinion, already some we are already starting to go in that direction. So there are research programs which actually grew out of string theory, where people understand space and time not as fundamental, but as something emergent from a quantum description. And the major property of this quantum description is that it's an entangled state and that space and time are derived from entanglement. And as I said before, entanglement somehow is this glue which keeps this quantum mechanical whole together. So I think this is a very interesting step in the right direction. In particle physics, people have started to look at links between the behavior of particle systems at high energies and low energies, meaning at the very small and the very large, which is also a break with this typical particle physics paradigm where you say that if you go to small distances, to high energies, you get more fundamental. So this is the technical label is UV-IR mixing. UV ultraviolet refers to high energies. IR infrared refers to low energies, and people have started to look into relations between these regimes. And I also think this is a very interesting step in the right direction. And maybe this may help us to understand better some coincidences, like why is the mass of the Higgs particle so light, or why is the dark energy in the universe, which is accelerating the expansion of the universe, so small? So I think these are steps in the right direction, but I don't have a full theory, or I don't know the complete path how we actually achieve such a moonistic description of nature.
Okay, so what I'm struggling with is the universe as a quantum object. So, I mean, everything I've learned about quantum mechanics applies to very small particles. And when you get into macroscopic and larger objects, quantum mechanics doesn't really dominate the discussion. So this entanglement is what connects everything. Is that your theory?
But
the universe
is, there's a reason for why we think that quantum mechanics applies only to small objects. And the reason is that small objects don't interact a lot with the environment. So they are not subject to decoherence. And decoherence destroys the experience of quantum phenomena. Even if the entire system is still a quantum system, we don't experience it as a quantum system, since it interacts with the environment, and this leads to decoherence. So with a proper understanding of decoherence, quantum mechanics is not restricted to small objects, but quantum mechanics applies to everything. And, for example, if we look at the Nobel Prizes of 2022, they have found quantum correlations between objects which were separated many kilometers. People have put objects as large as a C60 molecule, a buckyball, or a virus into quantum superpositions already. So, in solid state physics, we can have phenomena where we have two electrical currents going simultaneously in two different directions to have a superposition of that. So actually, people realize more and more macroscopic, more and more large quantum phenomena. And this shows that this traditional view that quantum mechanics applies only to the very small, that this is not correct, actually.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to do some more research on decoherence. I don't understand that, but I will go look at that. Another question.
Go ahead, John.
So how does monism relate to panpsychism? In other words, the idea that inanimate objects can have consciousness. Have you thought about that?
Yes, a little bit. So, of course, nobody really understands what consciousness is right now. But in my opinion, I think consciousness is probably something which is related to how information is processed. Since we know ourselves, we can be conscious, and we also can be not conscious, for example, in deep sleep or when we are in a coma or something like that. It's the same brain, it's the same matter, which can be conscious or not conscious. So it probably has something to do with how information is processed in the brain. And if information processing is behind consciousness, then, of course, information processing could happen also in other systems which are not humans or not animals or something like that. So on the other hand, I think this fundamental description of the universe in monism probably is a description which is devoid of matter, space, and time. It's only one thing, and it's not really assuming that there's a space or time. While I think consciousness is something which always happens in time. So I would speculate that consciousness is probably more like an emergent phenomenon, which doesn't exist on this very fundamental level, but is something which is, again, a property of our perspective, of our experience, which doesn't really exist on the most fundamental level. But maybe that's hard to swallow, even more hard to swallow than to say there's no time and no space and no matter on the most fundamental level, since consciousness, of course, is the only thing we really experience. And if we say this is, after all, an illusion, it's weird. But, I don't have the final answers to that, but these are my thoughts on that. And they are admittedly very speculative.
Do you think that there's a quantum mechanical mechanism behind consciousness similar to what Penrose and Amaroff have proposed with their, I think it's called OR model of consciousness?
Yeah, I'm skeptical about it. I mean, it might be that quantum mechanics plays a role there. Of course, decoherence is very powerful in large and strongly interacting systems. So there are some people who have said decoherence probably prevents quantum properties in the brain. Other people disagree. They say, well, quantum properties can be kept even in such strongly interacting wet, warm, macroscopic environments. But my main point is that I think everything is quantum mechanical. And if everything is quantum mechanical, then this is not something which distinguishes between conscious systems and non-conscious systems. So from that point of view, maybe quantum mechanics plays a role in explaining consciousness, but I think it can't be the most important thing, since if everything is quantum mechanical, conscious systems are not singled out from the point of view of quantum mechanics.
Okay. Well, great, great subject, and I look forward to reading your book, Heinrich, and thank you for coming on the show. I'll get off now, David,
for the
and let someone else call in.
Okay. Thank you, John. Listeners, there's time. You two can give us a call if you'd like, 866-687-7223. Email remains drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. We have an email from Connie in Houston, Texas. And Connie says, I have been reading your book since when you were supposed to be on the space show a week ago but had phone problems. You talk about monism, M-O-N-I-S-M, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, as a philosophy dating back to 3,000 years ago. How did civilizations from 3,000 years ago figure this out or come up with it? And were they operating and functioning with a quantum perspective? Is there any information about that? Or what can you say about the evolution from 3,000 years ago, and how did they come up upon this?
Yeah, that's a very good and, again, very hard question. And I must say this is also very amazing for me that people came up with ideas which are so close to how we would describe such a quantum reality today, many hundred years ago. And so I can only speculate. I don't have real answers to that. So we know that in certain states of certain altered states of consciousness, we experience, we have such a holistic experience that we are one with the universe or something like that. Or at least some people have experienced these things. when they meditate or when they have certain extreme experiences, when they are close to death, or when they take psychedelic drugs or something like that. And these experiences, or probably these experiences, contributed to these ideas. The question is, are these experiences somehow related to this fundamental quantum reality? And again, I don't know. I could speculate, and actually I do speculate in the book, maybe in these experiences, the information processing in the brain is altered in some sense, and maybe this altered information processing may somehow open up a glimpse of this fundamental quantum perspective. But again, this is highly speculative. I don't really have an answer. I'm also for me, it's also very amazing that people came up with these ideas so many thousands of years ago.
Well, so here's another email question that may amaze you or may give you a good giggle. Fred is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And he says, I have not read your book, but I'm very interested in it. Many people, rightly or wrongly, or scientifically, or believing in faux science, believe that early civilizations had contact with aliens or extraterrestrials that enlightened them and helped them build things that we can't explain even today. Is there any room in the way you perceive or understand anything to think that maybe some of these people from 3,000 or other decades or hundreds of years or centuries ago came in contact with enlightened extraterrestrials who taught them these things?
Well, maybe. I mean, I think it's probably not so unlikely that we are not alone in the universe. So if consciousness and life is possible on Earth, it probably is possible elsewhere. And it's not excluded that at some point people from elsewhere came here. So the question is, why did they go away again? And I mean, even more so, if they left something, why was the only thing they left these airy philosophies? I think this is rather unlikely that from all things they could have taught us, they taught us something so metaphysical and so fundamental and so at least on a first glance so far away from our everyday lives. So I think there probably are aliens. I think it's less likely that they ever have visited Earth. And the reason for saying this is that they have left so little. And I think it's very unlikely that they left only one thing, and that's this philosophy. But well, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
They're probably very hard to find that one out or to confirm that, right? What type of feedback do you get from your book from your peers as well as from the general public?
Well, it depends. I mean, it's mixed, but it's mostly positive. I got some very nice feedback from people doing quantum information science, which is not really my own field, and I didn't know these people, but they were professionals working with quantum mechanics, and so one person wrote a review and said, well, I'm thinking about quantum mechanics for my entire life, and I was always very skeptical about these ideas of taking quantum mechanics serious as a theory about nature and the many worlds interpretation, and now that I read your book, this seems to make sense to me. So I was very happy about that review. But of course, there are people who say, well, this sounds like New Age bullshit, or it might be true or wrong, but it doesn't really matter since it's metaphysical and it doesn't really have a direct impact on physics. But as I said, I think it's important to think about the ideas on which we base physics. And since this is informing the way we do science, I mean, the basic ideas we have about the universe is informing how we approach science, how we set up our theories, how we set up our experiments. And especially when we encounter problems and things we can't solve, it is important to reconsider the basis of what we are doing.
I have another email, and this is Paul in New York. And Paul says, frequently people will say in response to a question about the laws of physics on the space show and maybe elsewhere, do these laws of physics exceed or exist outside of the plane of Earth? For example, in another solar system, would we be looking at the same laws of physics in another solar system? Would the quantum experience and perspective that you're talking about be valid, or is this only for our world and our plane of information?
Yeah, good question. I think actually that it is highly not trivial that the laws of physics we have here on Earth are the same in other galaxies. But the idea I'm advocating that the entire universe is just one single quantum object, this is strongly supportive of the view that we have the same laws of physics everywhere, since it's just the same quantum object and it has some properties, and these properties, they are encoded in the laws of physics. And if it's just one object, of course, the same laws of physics apply everywhere.
That alone is pretty mind-boggling, that everywhere would follow the same rules of the road, so to speak. So that seems a hard thing to grasp, because nobody follows the same rules of road any place. So
yeah, that's true.
and so I wonder if there's a whole list of exceptions where in this world you can violate this law by doing this, this, and this, and in this galaxy we found that you can violate this law by doing that, that, and that. It just seems almost beyond the grasp of a human mind that everything operates identically with the same set of rules, especially if our here we go with perspective. If our perspective here on Earth is, hardly anybody operates from the same set of rules. And often there's not even any consequences even for violating rules like killing another person. There often are no consequences for violating these rules. So, and then you say there's a master set of rules that applies everywhere. So how do you explain that?
I think this is something actually most or almost all physicists will agree on, that if you have different sets of rules in different places, then these rules are not fundamental. And what physics tries is to get the fundamental rules from which all other rules are just derived. So, of course, cultural rules are very different from one place to another, on which side of the street you drive, or
right,
whether something is allowed or not. But the laws of nature, they are, as far as we can tell, the same everywhere. And again, it depends how much you go down and to the foundation. I mean, biology, for example, can be very different in a different galaxy. And but the laws of physics, we expect to be the same, since we expect that they are really fundamental. And if they are not the same, then we would say, well, we didn't really find this this fundamental level yet, so we have to dig deeper.
Since we're on a program called The Space Show, and we typically talk about ways to do commercial space or even planetary science and other things with space, what is the role of quantum physics, or how do you see the role of the quantum in going into outer space and trying to live on another planet with space settlement or space tourism or building new rockets, which, you know, many companies are trying to do to get better access to space at cheaper costs. If we just limit our world right now to developing space, what is the role of quantum in developing space?
I don't have a very good answer to that. I think, I mean, there's a lot of research going on in quantum information science, and maybe that will help at some point to build better computers or to find better algorithms for solving problems. And this, at some point, may also help going into space. But I don't have an answer which will be relevant in the next few years.
Let me try this. If we were actually able to be on Mars with a human settlement on Mars, whatever that may look like, would thinking about everything being connected and one, especially having the perspectives of having lived on Earth all our life, and now all of a sudden this handful of people, or maybe more than a handful, are living on Mars that certainly has different rules, that maybe not down to the fundamental, would it improve the chances for survivability of a Martian settlement or colony by thinking in quantum perspectives, or would it just not be part of what you were doing developing a Martian colony?
Well, I mean, again, psychologically it might be comforting to think that we are all connected, and that even when we are in different places, we are still part of the same universe. But I can't see a practical application right now.
Is it important for this to evolve to where people such as yourself or others coming after you do see practical applications and then integrate it into our practical lives? Is that an important path in pursuing quantum theory and quantum science?
I think most people, and also I myself, we are just driven by, or mainly driven by, curiosity. It's not so much that we think a lot about possible applications, but we really want to understand how the universe functions. But as it has been shown that, I mean, this may be very fruitful, like the World Wide Web was developed at CERN, where people were thinking about little particles and how they could analyze these particles and how they could store information about what they found. And it was a real game changer for our culture. So I think it's not necessary to always have in mind specific applications when we think about things. Sometimes it's helpful to just forget everything and abstract to the deepest level and really to understand things, and then the applications come later automatically.
I have another question, and listeners, we're going to be coming up on the end of the program, but Sally is in Seattle, and she says, I'm curious, talking about curiosity, if you are teaching these subjects with your students and how your students grasp it and what they say and what they understand and what they don't understand? And would they be in terms of United States students, graduate students, or undergraduate students? I'd really be curious in their ability to grasp this and their perspectives, to use that word, and what they give you as feedback.
Yeah, I think many physics students are also driven by curiosity, and so this is what inspires them to study physics. It's not really that they have a specific job in mind or that they want to know something very specific, but they really want to know how things work on the most fundamental level deep down. So students are interested in these questions. And yes, I also teach them, but usually not in the standard courses. In the standard courses, they have a defined curriculum, and there they usually need to learn specific techniques to calculate things, to solve equations, to relate them to experiment, and so on. But I have a seminar which I teach every second semester, which is called the Big Question Seminar. And in this seminar, we discuss such questions like, what is time? What is space? What is consciousness? Can we all relate all these things to a fundamental quantum description, and so on? And I always have a couple of students coming to the seminar, sometimes more, sometimes less. But there are always students who are interested, and there are lively discussions. And I think most of the students are interested in these things, at least to a certain extent. And some of them are very interested.
Do you ever teach this, the big question, outside of Germany, online or any place like that where other people might be interested other than your students in Germany?
No, not yet really, but yeah, maybe that's a good idea.
You might have a pretty huge market for it. That's for sure. Okay, so I have one more kind of fringe question for you that I will go ahead and ask if it's okay with you. So this is Bill, and Bill is in the Washington, D.C. area of the country. And he says, I am a big fan and want to be a believer in time travel going backwards in time, not forwards in time. Is there anything in the quantum perspective that you've been talking about that would seem to make time travel going back in time feasible?
I cannot give a concrete answer. So the point is our best theory of gravity, general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, in principle allows traveling back in time. So, allows more in the sense of it doesn't forbid it. So what general relativity tells us is that space and time are curved and warped, and depending on what matter I have, I plug that into the equations, and then on the other side, I get a certain way of warping or curvature of space and time out of it. And if we put some exotic types of matter from which we don't really know whether they exist, but if we put that into the equation on the other side, we get some space-times which would allow it to travel back in time. So the question is, do these types of matter exist, and is there something more fundamental beyond general relativity, which is a classical theory, not a quantum theory, which forbids these specific space-times where you are allowed to go back in time? And I don't have an answer. I mean, I think it probably is very difficult to realize or to have a consistent theory where you can go back in time, but it's probably not impossible. And whether this is realized in nature is, at the end, an experimental question. What it's interesting in this context from the monistic perspective is that the monistic perspective favors a universe which on the most fundamental level is timeless. So it's the time is not really a fundamental feature of the universe, but something emergent. So maybe this idea could support the idea that one could also travel back in time, since time is not something which is the uniformity of time progressing always from past to future is not something which is fixed on the most fundamental level of the laws of the universe. But whether it's really possible, I don't know. And it's probably rather unlikely. But I think the final answer is still not there yet.
So Bill sent in a quick addendum, and he says, the reason I ask this is that American television resurrected a 30-year-old TV series called Quantum Leap into a new version, where they are using a quantum accelerator, whatever that is, to go back in time and interact in a way that corrects problems that happened back in another day and another time. And it's all based on a quantum leap accelerator. And when they have the scientists talking about the quantum leap accelerator, it seems like they're trying to talk in TV language about something with quantum science. That's why I asked the question. There probably is nothing like a quantum leap accelerator, but they've sort of made the TV show based on using quantum physics, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I never have heard about it, and I right now I can't make sense out of it.
So you just enjoy the TV show, people, if you like it. So do you go on any United States speaking tours? Is there any chance to come across you in the United States and meet?
Yeah, I will be traveling to the States in September, and I definitely will speak at Vanderbilt University. But I also would like to speak at more places, so I will start now to find out where else I could speak. So, yeah, I mean, if anybody's interested to have me somewhere, please contact me, write me an email. But, I also will try to contact some more places. And
any chance you might come to Las Vegas and speak in this area?
I don't know. I mean,
if there would be an
event set up, I would be happy to go.
So are you setting it up yourself, or is your publisher setting it up?
No, right now I'm setting it up myself. So usually I contact universities or contact at universities, and they set up a talk in a colloquium or some public science format or something like that.
I can talk to some of my friends at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas campus, and maybe they, I know people in the engineering and in some of the other departments, not in the physics, but maybe they'd be interested in having you come speak, and then I could come hear you and meet you in person. But
I would be happy to come.
I will send you a note later on about that, and maybe you'll also come to Los Angeles, where I could drive over for that as well. So there's a lot more universities in Los Angeles than there is in Las Vegas. But I think it would be fascinating to hear you talk in person and to get a chance to meet with you. So I would look forward to that, and maybe when you come here, we can do another program together with you using a U.S. phone line, and we can talk some more about this. It's a great topic. Listeners, you can tell that I've read the book, and I really, really like it, and I really enjoyed talking to you, and it's kind of right up my alley, and I think all of you would probably find it a deep thinking and enjoyable and curious read. So, again, it is titled The One, O-N-E, How an Ancient Idea holds the future of physics. So hopefully you'll check it out. Professor, it's been great talking to you. I will send you the archived information for the show, and hopefully we'll get a chance to meet in the near future, or at least talk again on the space show, and you'll come back again as we continue to explore what happened to that poor cat in the box, okay?
Okay, yeah, thank you very much. It was really fun to talk to you and all the listeners, and yeah, thank you.
Thank you again, and listeners, that's it for this morning. Remember, astronomer Dr. Alan Hale, the Hale of Hale-Bopp Comet, is our guest tonight at 7 o'clock, and we'll be talking much more conventionally, I'm sure, with Alan. But don't miss that program. And the week is young. Everybody have a great week. Stay healthy. Enjoy yourself. And as always on the Space Show, we encourage you to look up. Goodbye from Heinrich, David, and the Space Show.